Support for today's Mysterious Universe comes from Squarespace. Whether you need a portfolio to showcase your work, a store to sell your products and services, or a blog to share your ideas, Squarespace gives you everything you need to make your next move into a reality. With Squarespace's beautifully designed templates and customizable features, creating a beautiful website is a simple and intuitive process. Simply add and arrange your content with a click of the mouse. Start your free trial today at squarespace.com and enter the offer code MU to get 10% off your first purchase. Welcome to Mysterious Universe, Season 18, Episode 1. Coming up on this show, we've got Hacking Enlightenment, Parks and Recreation Black Ops, and Garrett Graff joins us to discuss his new book, Raven Rock, the story of the US government's secret plan to save itself while the rest of us die. I'm Benjamin Grundy. Joining me is Aaron Wright.
Well, not all of the rest of us. Some of us are on the list.
Some of us are podcast designated survivors.
Yeah, well, you need to entertain the survivors after there's been a nuclear Armageddon.
Should we do that? Should we have a continuity of podcasting team ready to go, like some kind of shadow podcasting team?
Why not?
In a bunker somewhere, then when we get wiped out, they're ready to pick up Mysterious Universe and keep going.
Yes, we will do that. That's a great idea.
Brand new season of Mysterious Universe. We're back after our week off. Brand new season, brand new Korean coffee to replace our Indonesian meth coffee.
Well, no, it was Malaysian meth coffee, and it did get to a point where it was just too much. We weren't sleeping properly, and it was interrupting our lives a little bit too much. So what is this stuff you've got us on now?
It comes from Maxim, which is a...
It's a magazine.
It's not the men's magazine. It's a Korean company that apparently they invented this mixture of coffee creamer and powder.
Oh,
the first company to do it. But you know what's weird? There's a weird bit of synchronicity of me buying this for our new season of MU, our powdered coffee, is in the new episodes of House of Cards, you know, the Netflix show with Kevin Spacey as the president.
Yeah, it's huge.
There's a particular episode later on in the season when they have to evacuate the president and the first lady and all the staff to the underground bunker that's under the White House.
Mm-hmm.
And just there's this little scene where they're all stuck in this bunker trying to figure out what's going on. And one of the women in there, she pulls out a long kind of packet of powdered coffee. And she just has this little comment of, oh, I have to go to Asia to get the best powdered coffee. And it just so happens I've always got some. So it's good that we're stuck in this, you know, bunker waiting for this nuclear fallout to pass over. I can still have my coffee.
Yeah, I get that. I mean, if there's nuclear Armageddon, you still want coffee.
It just struck me. It's weird that we're drinking this today. And the entire episode is going to be exploring some of these very underground, these very same underground bases, underground facilities that are designed and set up to protect the government again while the rest of us die.
Look, Garrett has done a fantastic amount of work, a huge amount of research, looking into these declassified documents, talking to people in the know about this whole concept of the continuity of government. What is America going to do, or at least the American government going to do, if there was a nuclear Armageddon? And while obviously this is all very important, going back to the end of World War II and all through the Cold War, things seem to die off. I mean, Russia or the Soviet Union fell and the Cold War drifted away. But now we're faced with all these new potential threats, and especially even this week with North Korea rattling the nuclear saber.
Yeah, I mean, we didn't plan to have all this timely news fall in line with this episode. I booked this this interview with Garrett weeks and weeks ago. But it was really the title that intrigued me. And I mean, the amount of research that is in this. We're going to have to talk about some stories out of this book after the interview as well.
Oh, we couldn't even broach it in the interview because it was just going for so long.
There is so much amazing stuff in here. And over at GarrettGraff.com, his website, they write that for 60 years, the US government has been developing secret doomsday plans to protect itself and the multi-billion dollar continuity of government program. And it all takes numerous forms. And we'll get into what those forms are in the interview, but equal parts a presidential, military, and cultural history, this new book, Raven Rock, tracks the evolution of the government plan and the threats of global war from the dawn of the nuclear era through to the war on terror. We hope you enjoy the interview with Garrett Graff. Joining us on the show today is Garrett Graff, the author of Raven Rock, the story of the US government's secret plan to save itself while the rest of us die. Great title, Garrett. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Great to talk to you guys.
Well, first of all, how long did this take you to write? Because I've never seen such an exhaustive amount of thorough research on this topic. It is absolutely incredible. How long did this take you?
So it was about 4 years start to finish. A lot of digging through libraries and archives and digging through declassified documents. The original way that I got interested in the book, though, about 5 years ago now, was I had been a national security reporter in Washington for about a decade and had bumped up against these plans, you know, which are known as the continuity of government plans, all of the weird stuff that would have happened during and after a nuclear attack in the United States. And, you know, I had talked to people who had been evacuated to some of these hidden mountain bunkers on September 11th. And I had talked to people who had been part of these plans during the Obama and the Bush years. I mean, people who literally had helicopters assigned to them that would find them wherever they were in Washington, evacuate them and fly them off to these mountain bunkers. But then about 5 years ago, one of my colleagues at the magazine that I was working in came into the office one day with a government ID badge that he had found on the floor of the subway parking garage on his morning commute.
Uh-huh.
And it was very clearly the badge of a U.S. intelligence officer. And he brought it into me and he said, "I'll bet you can figure out how to get this back to this guy, so that he, you know, won't have lost his ID." And I turn over the ID and I'm looking at it, and there are driving directions on the back of the ID.
What?
That say long-term evacuation. And so I can tell that these lead out of Washington, out through Virginia, out into West Virginia. And so I get on Google Maps and Google Satellite and start following these driving directions. And I realize when I'm looking at the satellite view that they end in this mountain in West Virginia, where there's this road up the side of the mountain, and there's this chain link fence, there's a guard shack, and then about 50, 100 yards further down the road, you see just these massive concrete bunker doors, and the road disappears into the side of a mountain. And I'm looking at this and I was like, wow, like this is one of those new mountain bunkers that I've heard that they've been building since September 11th.
Oh, wow.
You know, this was a facility that didn't exist on any map. I had never heard of it. And this whole thing out is still going on. And there are all these new facilities. And then that sort of set me down the path of researching them and figuring out, you know, what the history of continuity of government was.
Yeah, that's fascinating that you found a new facility, because when I think of an underground facility to protect against nuclear war or some kind of disaster, of course, I immediately think of the Cold War. But, you know, what's so interesting about your book is you're saying that even after the fall of the Soviet Union, it seems as though this underground world didn't disappear. It actually kept on getting bigger. But perhaps let's start with Raven Rock before we go into that, because we should talk about the namesake of your book. What exactly is Raven Rock?
So Raven Rock is a facility in Pennsylvania, about 2 hours north of Washington, D.C., that was built in the 1940s and 1950s and would have served during the Cold War as the backup Pentagon, the backup to the headquarters of the U.S. military. And it is a massive facility. I mean, remember, the Pentagon itself is the largest building, office building in the world.
Yeah.
And Raven Rock is actually not that much smaller. It is a hollowed out mountain with a freestanding city built inside of it. I mean, literally three-story freestanding buildings inside of the mountain. And it has absolutely everything that you could need to live underground for a month at a time. You know, it's got its own fire department, its own police department, its own medical facilities, its own dining halls. It's got these massive reservoirs for, you know, drinking water and the power plants, its own generators.
Is there a Taco Bell?
Well, it's funny that you say that, because at Raven Rock, there is not.
Oh,
but there are three of these very big facilities around the country, all built sort of roughly around the same time. Raven Rock in Pennsylvania, then in Virginia, about 80 minutes outside of Washington, there's a bunker known as Mount Weather, which is where the U.S. president would go and where the U.S. cabinet and sort of the civilian leadership would go. Then there's another military bunker in Colorado, which your listeners might know if they've ever seen the 1980s movie War Games with Matthew Broderick.
Of course, yeah.
And that bunker, which is known as NORAD, the North American Air Defense Headquarters, same thing. I mean, hollowed out mountain, you know, its own, you know, freestanding buildings inside. And it includes a Subway fast food franchise.
Oh,
that's correct.
So, hidden inside of the mountain is the world's most secure fast food restaurant.
That's incredible.
If you happen to be the cashier making the $5 footlongs on the shift where nuclear war happens, you will become the only fast food employee in the world to survive Armageddon.
What an incredible scenario. You'd really want to be rostered on.
Right. You'd just be there making your turkey sandwiches like any other day.
This is important that we bring this up, because the understanding of nuclear war, I mean, after the bomb was dropped on Japan, or the two bombs were dropped on Japan, it took a little bit of time before it really started to seep in what the implications of nuclear war would be. So what were some of the changes to America's approach to civil defense that needed to be thought about after the invention of atomic warfare?
Yeah, so I think that there are three really big arcs that this book traces. As you talk about the development of nuclear weapons and the rise of the technology behind nuclear weapons. So the first is the way that it changes and shapes the U.S. presidency. That, you know, before nuclear weapons, you didn't really need to be able to reach the U.S. president all that quickly. So as late as 1935, when Franklin Roosevelt was dedicating the Hoover Dam, his motorcade got lost in the canyons driving back to Las Vegas, and he just disappeared. I mean, he was out of touch for the entire afternoon. No one knew where he was, when he might appear, where he might pop up next. And that was totally fine. And as late as 1945, when Harry Truman started as vice president, the U.S. vice president didn't receive any Secret Service protection.
Wow. You know,
he just sort of wandered by himself through the streets of Washington, because the thinking was, you know, as long as you could find the vice president within a couple of hours, or, you know, by the next day, you know, that was fine. You know, that was all you really needed out of the vice president.
Well, you could really sense this this, you know, open frame of mind from presidents. You included this story of Truman shortly after he took office. He needed to do some personal banking, so he just walked out onto the street to his local bank, causing pandemonium. Yep. Once everyone realized where he was.
Yep. He had to deposit his paycheck, which, right, I just sort of love the idea of the president of the U.S. being handed their paycheck and then them being like, all right, well, I guess I should run down to the bank and put this in the checking account.
Is there, yeah, like a store nearby I can, yeah, cash this?
So bizarre.
Right. And so all of that had to change when you began to have these nuclear weapons that compressed time and decision making. And the idea that we have all of these fancy toys around the president of the United States now, the Marine One, Air Force One, the big armored motorcades. Well, what they're effectively are tools ensuring that the president is in communication with the U.S. military wherever he is and is able to launch a nuclear war wherever he is. While we're talking right now, the president of the United States is in Europe, and all of this apparatus is following him around in case he wakes up in Europe tomorrow and decides that it's time for nuclear war. It's really quite scary when you begin to think about it in that context.
Well, what really grabbed me was this whole concept of the continuity of government. When I was reading through the book, I was trying to work out, is basically continuity of government just so that someone is still alive to press the retaliate button, or is it more than that?
Well, so there are two different levels of this. One is the minute by minute, hour by hour, ensuring that someone is in control of the U.S. government and is able to push the missile launch button. Then there's sort of a secondary level, which I'm sure we'll get a chance to talk about, of like all of the weird stuff that would happen in the days and weeks and months after a nuclear attack or catastrophic event, how the U.S. government would begin to reestablish security and to try to rebuild after a nuclear attack. And that's where you get into the second and third arcs of the way that this history has unfolded in the 75 years since the end of World War II. Because, you know, when you talk about Hiroshima and Nagasaki, what's hard to remember today is that during those early years of the Cold War, during the early years of the atomic age, there really was an idea that nuclear war could be survivable.
Right.
You know, neither the Soviet Union nor the United States had all that many nuclear weapons. We didn't have very reliable delivery mechanisms. I mean, we just had people in airplanes flying basically with a compass, and you would have a lot of warning. I mean, you would have 8, 10, 12 hours by the time the bombers took off before they could actually make it to their targets. So there really was the idea early on that you would be able to have the civilian population be protected. You know, you would be able to evacuate people from major cities. You would be able to put all of the U.S. Congress on a passenger train and send them off into the mountains of West Virginia, which was literally the plan in the early years.
And you point out there was also support for the idea to almost remake remake society in a way, dispersing populations, dispersing cities, putting populations inside mountains, connecting them with underground subways and things like that. So people were thinking about it. It wasn't just a fantasy, right?
I'm actually really glad that you raised that. This is, to me, one of the weirdest details of the entire book, because, one of the things I really struggled with was going back and trying to recapture and understand what the mindset of people was in, you know, the 1940s and 1950s as they were starting. And there really was this very distinct movement at the end of World War II where people were like, well, it looks like we just need a total world government now.
Right.
You know, nuclear weapons have made it such that we absolutely need to have just one world government. No one government anymore can possess a military. It's just too big. It's too important. And what we sort of forget about today is that, like, that was a legit idea. I mean, politicians like Republican Harold Stassen, who led the 1940 Republican convention, Robert Oppenheimer, the father of the atomic bomb, who argued that the world just couldn't afford nationalism in the age of nuclear weapons. And then from there, when it became clear that we were just never going to have world government, then you had this idea, as you mentioned, that, oh, well, let's just remake all of the cities.
Yeah.
Let's just break apart the cities. Let's just bury cities. Life magazine endorsed the idea that life above ground was obsolete. And they wrote about how, you know, humans should be more like ants. Ants construct beautiful palaces and galleries, and many ants live long underground in entire satisfaction, which was just sort of this fascinating comment to me, because I was like, I don't really understand how you measure the happiness of ants. Like, I've never really looked at an ant and been like, oh, that ant seemed real. I'm happy today.
They love it down there.
You know, this was also the beginning of like fluorescent lights. And there was this big push of like, oh, well, you know, life underground is going to be great because there's going to be even fluorescent lighting everywhere. And you don't have to worry about sunlight anymore.
Oh, God.
And that all of this was actually real. And then from there, you know, getting back to your original question about how civil defense evolved, as those grand plans fell by the wayside, then we sort of shrunk down to, all right, well, let's just prep our cities for nuclear war. And, you know, you had New York City hand out dog tags to all of their school children.
Oh, my gosh.
And the city of Chicago recommended that parents tattoo their child's blood type onto their bodies so that they could be helped by medical personnel after a nuclear blast. And, you know, made sure to point out that you want to tattoo the blood type on the child's torso in case their limbs are blown off by the nuclear bomb. And I just can't imagine like slipping that note from the teacher into the child's backpack at the end of the day. And then we sort of went through this whole era of this fallout shelter craze and encouraging people to build fallout shelters in their backyards to protect themselves from nuclear war. And then as, you know, these nuclear weapons got stronger, they got more plentiful. We went from bombers to missiles, and that decision window closed to, you know, just 15 to 30 minutes. What you really saw was the idea that we would, you know, basically end up with the military plans that we have today, and the rest of the world would be vaporized.
Well, Garrett, well, I have to admit, when I first read your title, I mean, it comes across as this almost devious plan. It's a selfish plan to let everyone die and save yourself. But what you make clear is that the reality of nuclear war almost made this the only option, didn't it? I mean, when did this start to really seep into the understanding of the US government that they couldn't save everyone, that the only chance they had was this COG, continuity of government plan?
It actually seems like it was pretty early. By the 1960s and 1970s, this was very clearly the only option. But I think one of the things that was so poignant to me as I was tracing this research and writing about it was coming to understand how thinking about nuclear war changed the way that U.S. presidents approached the Cold War. And most people don't know that actually during the Cold War and even present day, U.S. presidents go through very extensive nuclear war drills. You know, during the Cold War, they like actually went out to these mountain bunkers and ran nuclear war exercises. You know, they were actually evacuated up into the presidential doomsday planes. The U.S. has this fleet of 747s separate from Air Force One that are just airborne command posts that follow the president of the United States wherever he is with a full staff of nuclear war planners to help the president run nuclear war for 3 days from the sky.
Yeah, I was reading that their engines are always up and running, ready to go. Is that correct?
Yes. So there is always one of these planes close to the president, either in the air or on the grounds. When the president is in the United States, it sits on a runway in Omaha, Nebraska at Offutt Air Force Base. And its engines are on, and there's a full battle staff just sitting there.
Wow.
And that plane can be airborne with that full battle staff in just 12 to 15 minutes.
And towards the end of the book, you spoke about these classified, unacknowledged Gulfstream planes, unmarked, that will follow the president everywhere. Can you tell us what they are, and how did you find out about them?
This is really the president's secret air force. I mean, part of what makes it so huge and hard to move a U.S. president around the world is it's not just Air Force One that flies around with the president. So you have all of these transport aircraft that fly in, you know, days or weeks ahead of a presidential visit and unload the limousines SUVs, armored battle vehicles, the electronic countermeasures vehicles, the presidential podium. I mean, sort of everything that you would need for the president. You know, the U.S. government is the only government in the entire world that provides what's known as a full helicopter package to its head of state everywhere in the world. I mean, you know, we fly those Marine One helicopters wherever the president is, anywhere in the world. I mean, literally every other country in the world will put its head of state on someone else's helicopter and be fine with it, but not the United States.
Right.
But then beyond that, you have these presidential doomsday planes that follow the president around. And then you had, for more than 30 years, this little fleet of Gulfstream jets, sometimes with U.S. government markings, sometimes totally anonymous white business jets that hide out at airports close to where the president is. And they are just there to evacuate the president in the event of a, you know, an attack on Air Force One itself, or, you know, for some reason, the need to evacuate the president. And they are specially designed to land at the special secret runway just a couple of miles away from Mount Weather in Virginia, that presidential doomsday bunker. Their landing requirement is exactly the length of the runway that's at Mount Weather, so that, you know, you can hustle the president from wherever he is up into his mountain bunker.
Just the level of detail that's been planned for is insane. I mean, you're using that term, the special secret runway, for these special secret Gulfstreams and all these special secret teams and planes. And Aaron and I were blown away by this little special secret detail you included about Air Force One, how it was seen taking off in a strange way after 9/11.
Practically vertically.
Yeah, can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so on 9/11, the president was reading to a group of elementary school students in Sarasota, Florida. And he was evacuated from the school as the attacks started. They raced the motorcade back to Air Force One and really thought at that moment that there was a chance that the president himself might be targeted. They knew that the Pentagon had been hit, and the first report of Flight 93, which had crashed in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, the first report of that was that it had crashed near Camp David, the president's weekend retreat. We now understand that that was totally unrelated. It was just that was where the plane went down. But they believed that there might be a real attack on the president. And so they wanted to get the president up into the air as quickly as possible, get him out of reach of any surface-to-air missiles. And so they activated, for the first and only time, a classified system that exists on Air Force One that helps speed almost a rocket-like launch. And the people on the ground who watched it, you know, reported that the plane appeared to go almost straight up.
How is that possible? How is that? I mean, how could it do that? Wouldn't it tear the airframe apart? I mean, what have they got on board that thing?
I know a little bit more than I'm saying here.
Oh.
But this is one of the areas where I did have some reluctance to get too deep into classified information in case it was useful to someone trying to attack Air Force One down the road.
Sure.
It's just highly advanced. Let's leave it at that.
We'll just say it's anti-gravity rocket technology. Okay.
Right. It's basically a wormhole that Air Force One is able to open up and transport into the sixth dimension.
They got that from Roswell.
Yep.
Great. Well, I like that we went on that little tangent. But I think we should hit on some main themes because we're running short on time. I did want to just briefly talk about how involved private enterprise was in the building of all these underground facilities throughout the Cold War. And I wanted to ask whether that still exists today. You know, does...
Well, we know Subway's involved.
Your Subway's clearly got an underground base. Does AT&T still have underground facilities? You know, does Google have underground facilities?
Yeah, so this was also another surprise to me of the extent to which the private sector is very closely involved in these plans, even more than people might think. And so during the Cold War, we actually hid large chunks of this continuity of government apparatus inside AT&T facilities. From the outside, these appeared to be AT&T communications facilities with AT&T employees, but they were secretly U.S. government continuity of government personnel. But then beyond that, you have all of these special powers that were given during the Cold War to private citizens, which I found really eye-opening. Dwight Eisenhower actually deputized, sort of pre-deputized, really, 8 men who were leaders in the private sector, including actually a guy, Axel Nielsen, who was his personal accountant, who would each step in to run a different sector of the U.S. economy.
Are these the czars? Are these the industry czars? Right.
They were basically dictatorial czars. You know, there would be one in charge of housing, one in charge of manufacturing, one in charge of setting prices and wages and rations. And they just went about their daily lives as CEOs or business leaders. And then in the event of an emergency, they would whip out these special credentials and these special letters of authorization and effectively like seize almost the entire U.S. economy. Then later on during the Reagan years, there was this thing called the Presidential Successor Support System that was built around the idea that you would very likely lose your top national leadership in the opening minutes of a nuclear attack. And so they had this whole special program known as the Presidential Successor Support System, PS3. And it had all of these private citizens who had one time been former high-ranking government officials, people like Donald Rumsfeld, people like Dick Cheney, who would be whisked away from their private life in the event of an emergency. And whichever bunker the presidential successor ended up in, there would be these PS3 teams waiting there. So these PS3 teams would spread out across the country and await a presidential successor showing up there. And then, you know, you would get to the bunker as the Secretary of Agriculture or the Secretary of Education or something. And Dick Cheney would be standing there in the bunker and he would say, "Hi, I'm your new chief of staff and I'm here to show you how to run the government."
Yeah. And this brings up a term that we often hear in our, you know, conspiracy circles on this show. It's a term that gets thrown around a lot, this idea of a shadow government. But you have pointed out that this shadow government is very real. It's been a very real thing that's been implemented for decades. It doesn't quite operate in the way that it's understood in some conspiracy circles. But what is the shadow government in terms of the continuity of government plan?
One of the things that surprised me in the course of this research was understanding that there really are kernels of truth inside all of the conspiracy theories you've ever heard about this world. You know, as you say, there actually sort of is a shadow government, you know, waiting in the wings, waiting in these mountain bunkers, ready to step in and run the country. And there's, you know, we all know about the presidential football, the nuclear briefcase that follows the president wherever he goes. Well, at the same time, through much of the Cold War, there was something called the Attorney General's Emergency Briefcase that followed him wherever he was going. And it had all of this draft legislation and executive orders declaring martial law, suspending habeas corpus, suspending civil liberties, and even had a list of thousands of possible subversives and foreign agents that FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover had identified, who the Attorney General would just sign this one document known as the Master Arrest Warrant and arrest 10,000 subversives and hold them, you know, without charge through some sort of national emergency. And it's pretty unclear whether these plans have modern analogs.
Yeah.
I mean, we don't really know and actually have every reason to believe that many of these plans are still in existence in some format, and that there is probably today all of this draft legislation and draft executive orders just sitting on a shelf somewhere waiting to be filled in, you know, Mad Lib style,
yeah.
with the dates of the emergency, the name of the enemy, and then the signature of whoever happens to be attorney general or president at that moment.
So Elon Musk is waiting there to take over the government when anything happens.
That might very well be true. I mean, that was literally the plan, you know, not for Elon Musk specifically, but for an Elon Musk of his own era to do exactly that earlier in the Cold War. And so, you know, for all we know, you know, Elon Musk and Jeffrey Immelt, the head of GE, and Mark Zuckerberg all have, you know, secret government credentials hidden away in a safe, just waiting to step in and run our country later.
With all these new conspiracy theories coming to mind, you know, with everything you're saying. You document this incredible buildup of underground facilities throughout the Cold War. But of course, after the fall of the Soviet Union and perhaps the zeitgeist around nuclear weapons not being so fearful in the recent years, has the upkeep or the maintenance or the building of this underground world to whisk away the government and private citizens, has that kind of fallen into disrepair, or has it gotten bigger? Is it still there?
Yeah, so the answer is a little bit of both. At the peak of the Cold War, there were more than 100 of these bunkers and relocation facilities spread around Washington. Effectively, every government agency, every government department had its own bunker or relocation facility. Most of those have been closed, but the three big bunkers, Mount Weather, Raven Rock, and NORAD, are all still active. There are other bunkers hidden around the country that are still active in places like Maynard, Massachusetts, and Denton, Texas. In fact, many of the larger bunkers, like Raven Rock, like Mount Weather, like NORAD, have been reopened and re-expanded in the 15 years since 9/11. And, you know, NORAD right now is being rebuilt in part because of some of these new threats that we're facing. You know, NORAD is sealed against EMP attacks, and so, you know, would be well protected in the event of a North Korean missile strike. But then in Hawaii this spring, you saw state leaders begin to reinspect and resupply their Cold War fallout shelters because of their worries and fears of North Korea again.
Really? Well, let's stay on this North Korea hypothetical as we're trying to leave our audience with a sense of a scenario here. What would you see playing out if there was a strike on the United States today, a nuclear strike? What would start to happen? What would the plan be? Run us through some of the immediate things that would happen and what would take place.
A lot of these plans have shifted since 9/11, in part because the modern threats, you know, a terrorist group, a rogue state, is less likely to look like a Soviet global thermonuclear missile attack. So you see a lot more emphasis in U.S. plans today on devolution, not evacuation. And so, you know, thinking that you would lose the president and senior officials and senior government leaders, you know, in a surprise attack on Washington by a rogue state or a terror group. And so you need to have these facilities up and running, and you need to have them staffed 24 hours a day to guard against that. And that's been an evolution both in reaction to 9/11, but then there was another event in the 1990s, which some of you might remember, when a Tokyo cult launched a sarin gas attack. And it was those two surprise attacks that led the U.S. government to, you know, effectively box up a spare government and hide it away in these mountains so that if something did happen to Washington unexpectedly, you would still have people out there ready to take control of the country.
Well, your book has the title, The Government's Secret Plan to Save Itself While the Rest of Us Die. And in your final chapter, you do write about this new fad or culture of doomsday prepping. Is there any way we can change that part of your title, While the Rest of Us Die, to While Some of Us Survive? Is there anything we can do? And is the doomsday prepping justified?
So I think that it's absolutely justified if you want to think about this. The challenge that planners faced throughout the Cold War was most people just don't want to think about nuclear Armageddon for all that long. And so you might be able to, in a specific crisis, get people to stock up on water or stock up on food, but they don't want to go out every 6 months and rotate their food stocks and rotate their water in their backyard bomb shelter. And so people lose interest in this pretty quickly. And I think that that's a pretty natural human response. I mean, I certainly wouldn't want to devote 2 weekends a year to, you know, rotating the canned goods yeah. through my backyard bomb shelter. But at the same time, I mean, I think you're right that one of the big lessons of this is that if anything ever happened, you know, you would very much be on your own, you know, at least for the first 1, 2, 3 months after some sort of large-scale catastrophe, you know, until they're able to actually come back to some semblance of a national government.
And the question is, will that government still be democratic when it comes back?
And the answer from the planners pretty specifically is absolutely not.
Right.
For the first 6 months or a year after any sort of large-scale catastrophe, you know, the U.S. would be a dictatorship. And then the question is, how quickly or at all do you begin to move back to something that looks like the democratic government that we're used to in peacetime?
Well, Garrett, it's absolutely a pleasure to have you on the show. What a phenomenal amount of research and a really spectacular book you've put together. Thank you so much for joining us. I feel like my biggest mistake was not booking you for 3 hours. We only scratched the surface. So thank you again.
Thanks so much for having me. This was a blast.
Huge thanks again to Garrett for appearing on the show. The book, again, is Raven Rock, the story of the US government's secret plan to save itself while the rest of us die. You can find it on Amazon. It's available on Kindle. There's an audiobook version, and it's in all good bookstores. And you can find Garrett at garrettgraff.com. We'll link to everything in the show notes, of course, at mysteriousuniverse.org. Just look for Season 18, Episode 1. And there's so much we didn't get to talk about in the interview. We had a limited amount of time with Garrett. But Aaron, we spent 2 days reading this huge, incredible book.
And I still didn't fully absorb it.
There's so many wild stories from history in here, and we want to share some of those with you when we come back. Some of the weird secret facilities, some of the super secret teams that are set in place to whisk people and objects away in the case of a disaster or attack. All that and more is coming up on Mysterious Universe. Stay with us.
Squarespace is back and they're proudly sponsoring the first episode of Season 18 of Mysterious Universe. If you've got a great idea and you want to get it out there, Squarespace can help you create an eye-catching online platform that will bring your ideas to life. Whether you need a portfolio to showcase your work, or a store to sell your products and services, or a blog just to share your ideas, Squarespace will give you everything you need to look like an expert right from the start.
They're really great for travel blogs, and I was just thinking, wouldn't it be great if one of us had gone on an awesome holiday to a foreign country and could have done a travel blog using Squarespace, which they promised to do.
I know, I promised to do that. And I did take lots of photos, and I am going to put together actually a Squarespace site with all of it. I just didn't have time. But what I didn't realize is that because I've got these great award-winning templates and it's just so easy, drag and drop, I thought, you know what, I'm just going to do it. So tonight, I'm going to go home, I'm going to sit there for 10 minutes and create an award-winning website.
Can you buy the domain Gaijin Mario Des Mario Kart Disaster?
I'll try that. And in fact, if you sign up for 12 months, you'll get a free domain. But if you use the offer code MU, you get 10% off your first purchase. And once I have put the site together, yes, I'll let you know the domain so you can check it out, just so you can see how easy it is to create a beautiful-looking website from something that's seemingly very hard.
Just do it in 10 minutes. It'll take you 10 minutes.
Just
it'll look
do it
amazing.
Now.
Just
yeah.
do it now. We can wait. We'll sit here and wait.
But we're not going to sit here and wait for 10 okay. minutes.
After the show, maybe.
After the show. We'll see how we go.
So make your next move and start your free trial today at squarespace.com. Enter the offer code MU and get 10% off your first purchase. Again, that's MU for 10% off your first purchase. And we're back talking about Raven Rock, the new book from Garrett Graff. And I've got to admit that the reason that I got this book for the show was the title.
Really? You just, that's all you saw? Like, that's it? Need to come on the show?
The government's going to save itself and the rest of us are going to die. Immediately, I actually thought of, you know, some kind of crazy catastrophe, like an asteroid strike or...
I was thinking some type of pandemic.
Yeah, volcanic eruption or some kind of crazy virus or something. And I guess those plans for continuity of government, those COG plans, they... can be applied to other scenarios in a way.
Yes, absolutely. But as I was reading through this book and talking with Garrett and just thinking about this over the past couple of days, it really struck me that while the idea is a wonderful idea, I mean, it's like the continuity of, even though, you know, if it was a nuclear war, democracy would essentially be rescinded for a while, it is the idea of keeping the American way flowing. It's keeping the whole concept, keeping society going. Eventually, once we get over the nuclear fallout, we can reestablish and grow again. But then I realized, once you've got 1,000 thermonuclear weapons dropping on your country,
yeah.
we're not coming back from that.
Yeah, that's it.
It's completely futile.
It's the end of society. So we didn't get a chance to talk about the Single Integrated Operational Plan, the SIOP.
SIOP.
Which is something that's... well, it's the president's responsibility, but in the book, Garrett details how this plan evolved over time and how as each new president took office, the outgoing president would, and the, you know, the generals and the all the chiefs of staff and all that jazz, they would take the new president through the scenarios for this plan, through this SIOP plan. So I just took a little excerpt from the book where President Kennedy is being shown some of his options from Eisenhower. And some of this stuff, even for 1960 or whenever it was, just blows your mind. Like, Kennedy essentially had 16 options to retaliate or attack the USSR, ranging from option one, which was launching 1,447 nuclear weapons.
Okay, but at this time, back then, it would have been aircraft carrying bombs, right? The missiles hadn't come into effect by that point?
I'm not sure. Okay. No, I think they had ICBMs yeah. in the 60s.
Okay.
I might be wrong. But anyway, that's a lot of weapons.
It is, yeah.
But that would take a moment's notice just to launch that.
I was ready to go.
Just minutes. It's just, okay, go. 1,447 nukes, away we go.
And you have
and that would spread all the way up to option two, option three, option four, up to the final option, which was number 16, where that would be generating your entire force, which would be 3,423 nukes, but it would take 28 hours to get them all out. So it would 28 hours to generate that plan. Wow. So Eisenhower was communicating to Kennedy, what you've got to do, your responsibility, is to basically select the plan that best suits the retaliation or attack scenario.
But hang on, where's the difference between zero and 1,000 nukes?
That's what I'm thinking. It's just this, the numbers are mind-blowing, and Garrett communicates this in the book, that each president, as they came into office, the strange psychological feeling that would come over them and how that, you know, they would be quiet for days and they would just have to contemplate what this meant, that there was no coming back from this, that this was the end of possibly human life on the planet.
Yeah, it'd be mutual destruction.
It's just this really insane scenario And, you know, what was weird, this came up later, when they would run drills in the White House, they would run drills for how you would retaliate, how to respond to a Soviet attack, there would always be a mock president in these drills. And then I'd run through everything, you know, getting the suitcase, getting the football and getting the codes out and, you know, down to the, you know, metaphorical pressing of the button to launch the attack. And one of the commentators, one of the commanders who was running these drills made a comment and said, you know, every time we run this drill, even though the person who is the mock president, even though they know it's a drill and they know it's fake and they know there's no real missiles that they're launching, they never press the button.
Isn't that weird?
They never do it. And they'll even hesitate to the last minute in the drills until a weapon has actually, you know, like in the drill, struck the United States.
Right.
They just do not, even though it's fake, even though it's a mock thing, no one wants to press that button because and you can't even imagine the psychological impact. You're pressing that button, you're wiping out, like in a lot of those options from the PSYOP plan, you're wiping out 50% of the Russian population.
Yeah. I mean, just even if it's your enemy.
Civilians.
Yeah, and you're right. Vaporizing is the right word because when we're talking about, you know, even the smallest option here, 1,000 nuclear weapons, we're talking about thermonuclear weapons. So just to get an understanding of what that is, what was dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki were just standardized atomic weapons. They weren't thermonuclear weapons. So whatever the thermonuclear weapons are, they're 1,000 times more powerful than the weapons that fell on Japan.
Yeah.
So that just shows you just how devastating and how terrible they would be. But there was really, I mean, the Cold War got quite terrifying because there was this back and forth between Russia and America where they were both trying to build bigger and bigger thermonuclear weapons. And at one point, Russia created something that was the biggest bomb in existence. It was the Tsar Bomber or something like, it was along those.
I can't remember the name.
It's something like that, yeah. And that thing was incredibly massive. It was one of the biggest explosions in history. But then the Americans also set off one as well. And this was a large thermonuclear weapon. I think it was about 50 megatons, somewhere in that range. And it was about the size of a, I think it was a small car. So they hadn't miniaturized it yet. But when they blew this thing up, and I think it was a Pacific atoll where they were doing some testing, it left a hole in the ground that was 1,500 meters wide.
Yeah, and the island was gone as well.
The island
obviously.
Was gone.
Yeah.
Gone.
Yeah.
And no, the weapons are still there.
The discussion on whether to actually pursue thermonuclear technology was intriguing as well because, was it Truman or was it Eisenhower? But whoever it was very hesitant to do it. You know, you don't want, already the nuclear arsenal is terrifying.
Bad enough as it is.
And then you have this suggestion of, well, we can make it 100 times more powerful. And the initial thought was, well, no, let's not do that. That's insane. But then the intel's coming in. Well, the question that's asked is, well, can the Russians do it? And the answer is, well, yeah, likely. It's likely they're going to do this. It's inevitable that they're going to figure out thermonuclear weapons. So the American response is, well, we've got to do it.
Yeah. I mean, that was, I guess because we didn't live in that time, I don't think we realized just how precarious the situation was. And in fact, you know, thanks to technology as well, we did come very, very close to there being an all-out nuclear war. Because when NORAD, which is one of these facilities that we've been talking about, which was mentioned by Garrett, NORAD had sophisticated computer systems for the time. And it's kind of funny because they're talking about ENIAC, which is one of the first computer systems. Obviously, no power today whatsoever. Yeah. I mean, whatever, there was the size of rooms and rooms and rooms now fits into your iPhone or even smaller. But the reason why it was so sophisticated is you could use it to make better calculations for how to drop the bombs. But within NORAD, it had this detection system for looking at incoming missiles. And one day the alarm went off. And it wasn't a drill. They knew it wasn't a drill. The alarm was going off. There were incoming Soviet missiles. They were dangerous. They were going to hit America very, very soon. And the counter kept on going up. So it started at 2. Then it went to 200. Then it went to 202. Then it went to 2,000. And by the time it got to this massive number of nuclear weapons that were incoming, and the staff there had to make a decision of, well, do we retaliate? And as you were talking about the different number of weapons, Ben, they're getting ready to go, well, do I press 10,000 or what do? We have to contact the president. There's a whole point of maintaining the communication. It turns out that they stopped at the last second because they realized that there was an error in the computer system. Oh. There was a 47-cent chip inside one of the computers that was malfunctioning. And what it was doing, instead of inserting a zero to say everything's okay, it had been faulty and was inserting a 2. That's why it was going up in these twos, saying how many nuclear weapons were incoming, down to 47 cents.
That is nuts. It's
crazy.
But so even, close to the end of the world.
But even now, there was a report that was on 60 Minutes back in 2014. You've got young guys coming in that are working for the military, that are Minutemen, silo operators. They've never seen a floppy disk before, and yet that's the system that's being used for the launch protocols for America's nuclear weapons.
So there was a similar close call on the Soviet side. It was September the 26th, 1983, and the Soviets' early warning system immediately started warning that there was, I think it was five missiles coming in, nuclear warheads, American ICBMs. And the Russian equivalent of NORAD was staffed by Lieutenant Colonel Stanislav Petrov, and he's watching as it's one missile, two missile, and then three more coming up on the screen. And what's intriguing about this is the quote from him when he thinks back to this incident. He said, "I had a funny feeling in my gut." He had the same decision to make, whether he was going to retaliate against the United States with nuclear warheads.
It's going to make you wonder how intuition, you know, plays a role in these things.
It also goes back to that psychology of people just never wanting to press the button in the drills. But yeah, he said, "I had a really a funny feeling in my gut." And he added that when people start a war, they also just don't start a war with five missiles.
No, you know, that's all out.
That's why he didn't raise the alarm. He just let it go. It turned out that it was, again, some malfunctioning system where the sun heating up clouds, the heat was detected as the afterburner of a missile.
Isn't that incredible?
So just simple things like that get screwed up. But let's talk about some of the weird stories that came out of these underground bases. I loved the one of the first tales of the drills with that Eisenhower would run to test these continuity of government programs. And they would do all the evacuations, get everyone out of Washington, whisk them up to Raven Rock and the other secret facilities. And Eisenhower, back then, before you had, they would use planes or helicopters, they would drive, they would have a motorcade. But Eisenhower, he was supposed to be at Raven Rock by like 40 minutes or something. But it took him hours because on the road, he got stuck behind a farm tractor. Like the presidential motorcade is stuck behind this slow-ass farm tractor transporting, you know, feed or whatever.
I just have this image of Eisenhower down at the hall, like, get out of the way!
Well, he was. They were really pissed off that the road was too narrow. They couldn't do anything. So it was because of that slow-ass tractor that they said, okay, well, we've got to get a helicopter, or we've got to get planes, we've got to get everyone out quicker. And of course it was because the technology was increasing as well, that time just went down to where you basically had minutes. And there's all these scary scenarios where, you know, once the American system detects a bunch of Soviet missiles, yeah, you've got enough time to know they're in the air, then you've got about enough time to contact the city that they're about to hit, but then there's nothing that that city can do.
So why even tell them?
The phone call is, you're about to be obliterated, so sorry. But there's not enough time. They have like 5 minutes to evacuate. There's nothing they can do. So it's all these, you know, really terrifying scenarios.
I mean, it is terrifying, but I guess maybe there's a little bit of comfort in the understanding that all this planning has gone into effect. And I know the title of the book is that the rest of us will die, but you know, there is this planning that will try and keep civilized society running after something like this. And I was so surprised by even the obscure planning. And this is what grabbed me, because while they'll let everyone die, when it comes to cultural artifacts, there's actually special ops teams that are created to rescue them. For example, if there is a nuclear Armageddon and incoming Soviet missiles are approaching, special ops park rangers. That's right. The American National Park rangers, specially trained.
Oh, it's not Parks and Recreation.
No. Okay. Especially like just park rangers, though. Specially trained park rangers will drop into this mode of evacuation of the Liberty Bell. And they would get it and they would take it to the Appalachian Mountains.
How do they move it? Isn't that thing huge?
I don't know. I've got no idea. Obviously, they've got teams ready. Well, there were some teams that were ready, in fact, with even there was like a special ops type of deconstruction team. Or bulldozers. So if for some reason a nuclear missile hit the White House and the president was in there, they have a team that's set up with bulldozers to go and dig him out.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. There's a specialized team that basically sits at the ready. And like you're saying, it's a team of elite search and rescue people. And they have this really cool name. It's like Phoenix 19 or something.
And they're driving Bobcats.
They just sit there waiting for some future minuscule possibility scenario.
Yeah.
That the president will be under heaps of rubble and they have to get him out.
Yeah, and it doesn't end at the Liberty Bell. There's also another team that was established to recover cultural items such as the Declaration of Independence and the painting of George Washington.
They would rank the Declaration of Independence above the Constitution.
You've got to get one out if you only get one.
Well, if it's a scenario, like if there's a stream of lava running through... Where do they hold that stuff?
It's in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, but where?
Oh, I don't know. I'm not American.
We're not American.
When I go for my citizenship, then I will know. I'll make sure.
In that place where they have it, if there's lava running down the middle and you have a choice, you've got to get the Declaration of Independence first.
I like that, though.
Let the Constitution burn.
But like I said, there's something... I mean, even though it may very well be futile, there's actually something comforting about that. And it comes down to even cash, right? So they'd established that they'd set up this secret facility on Mount Pony. And inside Mount Pony, which is a secret hidden facility that no one knew about, there are rooms that are full of stacks of 9-foot-high cash. And I'm thinking, why would you do that? If there's going to be a terrible nuclear war, who cares? I mean, they're going to be using bottle caps. They're not going to be using cash. But no, the American government believed that they would have enough cash to keep society running until the printing presses can come back online.
That's right.
2 years after a nuclear strike.
They needed $4 billion in cash.
Yeah.
And that's the other thing is all these separate entities have their own underground facilities, or at least they did.
Mm.
So the Federal Reserve, for example, had their own underground facility where they could essentially operate in times of nuclear attack. Also, private companies like AT&T had their own underground facility. And because the building of these things was so prolific during this time, there's all these wild stories. Like, there's a story of a bunch of spelunkers. I can't remember what state it was in. It might have been Virginia. Is there caves in Virginia?
I don't know.
Why don't you know these things?
Because I don't know American geography that well. I know it okay. I've been there quite a lot, but I don't know that well.
Anyway, there's cave spelunkers, and they want to go into this cave that they regularly go into because they're checking on a local bat population.
Mm-hmm.
And also, the deepest parts of this cave, it's very tranquil, and these spelunkers, they love going there. So they go on this trip, and they're going down into the tunnels, and it takes, you know, an hour and a half to get down to the deepest part of the cave where the bats are. And there's no bats, but there's a bunch of army soldiers, all this earth-moving equipment, and all these lights and pipes being installed. And these spelunkers with all their gear are like, what are you guys doing here?
Yeah. Did they get arrested?
They have to get shooed away because they're building some classified underground facility.
I think, to be honest with you, we may have only just scratched the surface in reality of what facilities are there. I mean, Garrett has done an incredible job, but I bet you there's just so much more that we don't know. I mean, the only reason why really we found out about Mount Weather, apart from, you know, some of the declassified documents, was back in 1974, a Boeing 727 crashed there.
What?
Yeah, so a plane crashed there. Unfortunately, there was a lot of loss of life, but it attracted all of this attention. And then all of a sudden, people that were going there going, there's something very odd about this location. And the American government actually had to come out and say, yes, we have a facility there that is for communications. Didn't go any further, but now we know a lot more about what this facility is.
Yeah, all these facilities for communications.
I like it, though, that, you know, it's not completely that the American government had given up on the civilian population. Even recently, when I say recently, in the last, you know, we're talking last 20 years or so, there has been potential planning into what would happen in an emergency situation. And I think at one point, the American government was talking to leaders of business and places that have distribution centers, like Walmart, for example, on how they can create evacuation centers. So they were actually talking with the head of Walmart to see that if something terrible did happen, people could evacuate to Walmarts.
Right, so you just gather them together to be vaporized rather than individually.
Well, you just hope that they're on the outskirts of cities that are being vaporized.
Speaking of Mount Weather, did you mention Mount Weather?
I did, yeah, that's where the plane crashed.
There's a weird story with that.
Why?
That's a little bit paranormal in a way. It's a bit of a precognitive story. See, in 1962, there was this fiction novel released. It was called 7 Days in May. And the authors wrote about this military coup in the United States occurring. And in the book, they wrote about this underground facility where the government would try and escape to, basically. They called this facility Mount Thunder. And in this fiction novel, they wrote directions on how to get to Mount Thunder. And when members of the military read this fiction novel, they started to get very worried because the directions in the novel led to an actual secret underground base.
That's crazy.
And it was Mount Weather.
Is that just through some weird twist of fate?
Well, it reminded me of that fiction book that predicted the sinking of the Titanic.
Futility.
Yeah.
Yeah, which was published, what, 13 or 14 years before the sinking? It's a bit weird.
It's a little bit of a different scenario because the base was already built when this fiction novel came out.
So it's possible
that the word got to the authors or they had heard, you know, rumors about it. But it's still odd because, I mean, it was incredibly secret.
I guess the only difference is that maybe if you were thinking about where would you put a base, you would look for a certain mountain somewhere.
Yeah, true.
And might have randomly said, well, that mountain looks like a great location. But, I mean, as I was going through this book, I mean, I must say a lot of these facilities are now just left untouched. But there was this one piece where I think an American, a member of the parliament, sorry, not parliament, or Congress, had asked to go into one of these abandoned bases. And when he went in there, there was dust all over the pencils because nothing had been touched. And all the names on the phones were from people 20 to 30 years ago.
Yeah.
So these bases are still there, but because obviously the Cold War died off, no one's using them.
There's a really crazy YouTube channel of a couple of Russian guys who do urban exploring, and they find a bunch of these places in the former Soviet Union in Russia. There's a bunch of these underground facilities, and you see them in their YouTube videos. I'll try and find a link to it for the show notes, but they pry open doors and they find all these ration packets left behind and all these hazmat suits and just stuff that's been there for decades and decades that no one's ever going to use.
No, but you can tour them now. There's some that are connected to hotels.
Oh, well, that's the Greenbrier Hotel.
Yeah, isn't that cool?
That is crazy. So the Greenbrier Resort, it's about 200 miles southwest of DC. Mm-hmm. It's in White Sulphur Springs. And this was the setting for Project X. So in Eisenhower's years, he grabbed a bunch of congressional leaders. I think there was only four of them that knew of the existence. And this place, Greenbrier, was one of the nation's poshest retreats. It was this beautiful mountain retreat, and it still is today. We'll put the website in the show notes.
We can go and tour it.
Yeah, and in August of 1955, Eisenhower got these leaders together, and it just so happened that this resort wanted to expand and build a conference facility. And because it was on the train line from DC, and the owners of the train or the train line was the same company that owned the resort, it created this opportunity for the government to come in and say, hey, can we work together and build a super secret underground facility under your resort?
Sure, why not?
And the owner of the resort and the train line said, yeah, let's do it. So they managed to build this kind of sprawling official expansion for the hotel and the resort. But underneath it and paid for by the government was this 90,000 square feet of secret base. And in the book, Garrett's got photos of it. And I'm sure if you search online for Greenbrier,
I'll put some in the show notes.
Base, you'll find these as well. Basically, in one of the conference rooms, there was a secret door. And you can see in the picture, it's kind of just melded into the wall.
In wallpaper.
It's like James Bond. Like, you pull a secret panel and the thing slides open. And then there's this hidden facility in there surrounded by reinforced concrete walls. And they're 5 feet thick. It extends 720 feet into the mountain that's next to the resort. And basically for decades, thousands of people used this conference room with no idea that right next to them was this huge cache of weapons and explosives, and there was basically everything that would be needed in there to run Congress underground.
Yeah.
And it was there that whole time. The most bizarre part of the story, and all the details of this are in the book, but I can't remember why it was eventually revealed that the underground base was there. Eventually, the staff of the hotel learnt about it. And when they learnt about it, there was a pre-prepared government-made VHS tape.
Oh, that's right.
And
this is like Fallout.
Yeah,
the whole thing's like Fallout.
The owner of the hotel had to grab all the staff in this really weird... Imagine the meeting. Like, you'd be thinking, what's the boss want? What's this meeting about? And you get taken into this room and he puts in this ancient VHS tape. The music's all wonky and it's like... And there's some guy from the 1950s explaining that, oh, hello, Greenbrier employees. If you're watching this VHS tape, it means that you've discovered the secret underground facility underneath your hotel. And it goes on to explain that it's part of some program between Greenbrier and the United States government, and it's all above board.
That's amazing. And you know what? I mean, it's easy for one to become a little bit conspiratorial, because when you start just realizing the gravity and the expanse of these bases, when you go back and look at some of the stuff that we've covered on the show before, and even mentioning things like, I know that Richard Sauder has a reputation for being a bit of a kook, but he has done a lot of research into underground bases and these stories of there being hyperloops and whatever else. If they were capable of building these facilities that were so secret for so long, and it's only come out now, just imagine the high level top secret stuff that may actually be there that we have just no comprehension about. And to show you just how secretive this was, remember the television series The West Wing? I think it was with Martin Sheen or whatever it was. There was someone who was working on that as a production assistant, and they were a former advisor to the White House, a very high aide up, and they were providing advice so that they can keep the show authentic. Mm. And there was this scene where one of the actors was given this little card that you break open, and when you break open the card, it details instructions on where to go in the event of a nuclear attack or in an emergency. And of course, this former aide went over to the director and said, no, you can't do that, because that's not genuine. That doesn't really happen. This is a top aide, right? But then the director turned around and said, no, that's actually come from someone higher up than you, and that really does happen.
Oh.
So despite being that high up, they weren't on the list and had no idea that other people would have been evacuated.
Yeah, that was made pretty clear that in most cases, the staff within the government didn't really know where they were meant to be going or what would actually happen. And a lot of plans were eventually changed because there were evacuation points and underground facilities and designated spots for, say, a congressman, for example, but nothing for their family.
Yeah.
So you would have these situations where the person is expected to evacuate, but just leave their children and their loved ones behind?
Which on paper seems fine, but in the reality of a situation, that's not going to happen.
Well, in reality, no one would want to evacuate.
No, exactly.
I mean, most people would say, no, my number one priority is my family.
But they even had plans in effect that they would have these teams, and they even expected that the president would be vaporized. So that's why they had it set up that there would be this continuity of government where other people could just step into the role, as what Garrett was talking about. I just find that crazy. You would have thought the president is the person that they want to protect, and for the most part it is. But then they also go, well, if Washington, D.C. is going to be vaporized first, well, then we've got these backup plans.
Well, wasn't Garrett saying towards the end of the interview, I'm not sure how much you edited, but that was really the plan now, is that it's more likely that there'll be some kind of surprise attack and there'll be a decapitation event, which is a technical term used to cut off the leadership. And that's why you have a shadow leadership ready to go, basically.
Yeah, essentially, I don't think I included much of that just for the sake of time when I was editing. But yeah, it comes down to the fact that if there is going to be an attack today in our global geopolitical climate, it's highly likely that it will be something that will be focused on one location, such as Washington, D.C. And then, of course, the rest of the country will be left unaffected. But it will be affected through economic reasons and, of course, the destabilization of the government. So that's why they have these secondary governments, the shadow governments, sitting there ready to step in and keep law and order going. It's just crazy stuff. I mean, I like it that they're planning, but also for some reason, you don't want to think about it. You don't want to, it's like planning your funeral. No one wants to do that. No one wants to buy life insurance. No one wants to deal with that. But sometimes you have to, because you have to think about what if. And that's what the government really has done.
Well, it's a question that I wish we had more time to ask, Garrett, has the fall of the Soviet Union decreased the chances of some kind of nuclear attack? Is the rise of terrorism and rogue states, is that an increase?
Is it
more likely to occur? And the zeitgeist around nuclear weapons has just kind of, as you said, no one really wants to think about it.
Well, after we were discussing Hiroshima on the Plus episode, the first one back for this season, and being over in Hiroshima, and I was obviously reading this book, I actually watched this documentary on the state of nuclear weapons in the Soviet Union. And the problem is, well, not the Soviet Union, former Soviet Union. But you're right, you have these degrading facilities that are breaking down, and people may actually be able to get in there and just take nuclear weapons, which is terrifying when you think about it. And they may not be able to launch them because they may be out of date and maybe the fissionable material inside has degraded, but it still leaves us very open to potential threats from rogue states and terrorists.
And he details all the broken arrow cases as well.
Oh.
You know, where there's a military guy with a clipboard counting all the nukes And he's like, eight, nine. Oh, we're missing five nukes.
Oh, dear.
Oh.
Like, I think there was a plane that I was doing an exercise and it accidentally loaded up live nuclear weapons. It flew across the country, landed, and then stayed at, I think it was a civilian airport overnight, yeah. Unguarded.
That was the most recent one. That was like 3 years ago.
Nuts. Yeah. Absolutely nuts.
Fantastic, intriguing history in Raven Rock. It really is an exhaustive history as well. I mean, you have to be prepared to delve into every little detail.
You got to give it time.
If you want to get into this book, we'll link to it in the show notes again, Raven Rock from Garrett Graff. Now, coming up in our Plus extension, I'm going to go into part two of Stealing Fire, how Silicon Valley, the Navy SEALs and Maverick scientists are revolutionizing the way we live and work. I touched on this on the Plus episode on Tuesday, but we got totally derailed and sidetracked by...
Speaking of touching on...
by One Taste and their Om Meditation Madness, which is basically where you unlock your mind by getting some stranger to masturbate you for 15 minutes.
I still can't believe it.
A really highbrow stuff on that last Plus extension or Plus show. But going into more of this, it gets...
Not the masturbation.
No. Going into more of Stealing Fire, the authors are trying to unlock this altered state of consciousness known as ecstasis. And the idea that when we let go of our ego and we manage to synchronize our thinking and act and think as one in teams and in groups, it can have really positive and incredible benefits to what, you know, whether it's a team sports situation or, you know, the Navy SEALs are another example, or any kind of, work situation.
Right. Yeah. Any group mentality.
Yeah.
But you're saying ecstasis, is that what you're saying it was called? Is that like some type of, turn of the phrase of ecstasy?
Yes.
Because you know how exactly. We've had those old stories about, I think it wasn't Padre Pio, but there was allegedly this saint who would go into raptures of ecstasy and then would levitate. Is it kind of along the same?
It's like that, but it's in a group situation.
Right.
And in the last Plus episode, we spoke about the Navy SEALs pushing the integration of this altered state of consciousness with technology.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the examples is from their new Mind Gym, which is this very expensive facility. And one of the things they had installed were float tanks. And in these float tanks, it wasn't just your regular float tanks full of salt water. It was float tanks with, and they couldn't go into details on what was in there, but it was like EEG sensors, a bunch of technology, all running in combination with the altered state induced by the float tank. And this would cut down the time to learn a new language for the Navy SEALs.
To 6 weeks or something, wasn't it?
Yeah, so to get them field ready with a new language would usually take 6 months, which is, I think, is already pretty damn good.
Yeah, definitely.
But they could cut that down to 6 weeks if they were using the flotation tanks and all this extra technology. So where this ultimately goes is a bit of a scary place as well. And this is turning into a very doom porn episode because ultimately it seems as though there is some clear evidence that we can use new technologies and new technical applications to kind of hack our consciousness to put us in these altered states that, you know, for example, extreme athletes use for peak performance.
Yeah.
But the question is, who controls that technology?
Oh,
and there's
yeah,
some
good point.
Pretty scary future scenarios of where this goes. John C. Lilly comes up, including a strange psyop that was performed on John C. Lilly by the CIA. And there's also some weird experiments with chimps.
Oh, great.
And I know you like that.
We like chimps. Yeah, we like chimps at the show.
We always like chimps. We'll throw some chimps in. I've also got an update on that frozen Indian guru.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, what a great way to return to the season.
Ashutosh Maharaj, the continuing saga of the question of, is he just frozen in a block of ice but still alive, or is he actually dead?
He is not dead. He is just a little bit frozen.
The final solution has come from the court in India, a final ruling on that ever-pressing question.
I bet you it's the opposite of what you expect as well.
What else have we got? We've also got a strange story about a man and a raccoon coming up in Plus. So many reasons.
Cutting edge.
So many reasons to sign up for Plus. Head to mysteriousuniverse.org/plus for all the details. Everything's there. It's $9 a month and you get access to the huge extensions we do on the end of these shows every single week. And I shouldn't really say on the end of these shows. It's almost like a whole other show. once we do the break.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean,
nuts.
The last one we did for the last episode of...
Man, that was... No, I'm going to bone to pick with you on that one because that was absolutely exhausting.
That's like 2 hours. 2 hour extension. And the end result was basically Spirit Monkey. That was the end. So sometimes...
Well, it takes 2 hours to explain a Spirit Monkey.
It's not going to be that long. It's going to be... almost double the show if you sign up for Plus. In addition to that, you also get an entirely exclusive show every single Tuesday. You also get a higher bitrate feed. Discounts on our store. We've still got the 50% off thing running for Plus members on our old back catalogue shows. And you get all the ads stripped out of our podcasts as well. Again, all the details are at mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. It's the best way to support what we do here at MU. And keep the show going. Make sure you check it out. Along with the show notes, look for Season 18, Episode 1. We'll link to everything in there. And, of course, the book, Raven Rock. That's a wrap for this opening episode of Season 18 of Mysterious Universe. Thanks for listening. If you're on Plus, stick around for the awesome stuff after the break. For everyone else, we'll catch you next week. Welcome back to your Plus Extension. Great to have you with us. I was debating whether or not to go back into...